It's all okay.
It's fine.
Just waiting for the last ones to settle down. Just like we've been waiting for the last two or three days for the mind to settle down in meditation. And I think many of you have begun to understand, especially those who just started this meditation, for the mind to settle down, it has to be comfortable. In the same way, if you haven't got enough cushions under your bottom, if you haven't got enough support behind your back, you'll always be fidgety and uncomfortable. And because you're uncomfortable, you always have to move. Because you always have to move, the body can never rest. It's the same with the mind. Unless the mind is comfortable, it's got enough cushions underneath it, as it were, you can never allow the mind just to rest and be peaceful, to be still. So the whole idea of meditation is getting to that comfort, that sense of ease, where the mind can get really, really nice and really still. So part of the explanation of meditation, another angle which gives you the idea of what you're supposed to be doing and what's happening and how the whole thing works, comes from a simile which I love to give. I give very, very often. If you look at that stained glass window above the Buddha statue behind me, right in the center is a big lotus. And a lotus has always been a symbol of Buddhism, even to the point that the software company Lotus was actually founded by a Buddhist over in the US. And that's why he gave the name to his company Lotus. And a lotus is not just a symbol of IT. It's also the symbol of Buddhism. And one of those reasons why it's a symbol is the idea that a lotus at night time closes up all its petals. So if you see a lotus, either very early in the morning or during the night, you'll find that all its petals are closed up in just one flower bud. And the outermost petals are usually very rough and coarse because they have to withstand the wind, the rain, and also the dust. But in the first light of morning, when the sun warms the outermost petal of the lotus, then that outermost layer of petals opens up. And that will allow the sun to reach and warm the next layer of petals. So that can open up too, allowing the sun to fall on the next layer of petals. So that can open up. The lotus opens up layer by layer by layer, one after the other. And as one goes deeper into that lotus, you'll find that the leaves, or rather the petals, become more refined, more delicate, more beautiful, and more fragrant. The really beautiful and scented petals are right in the middle of that lotus. Now, what this simple symbol means is that when we're meditating, it's as if your mind and body is like a lotus, and we're trying to open it up to go deep within. But in order to go deep within, to literally open up our body and mind, we have to learn how to maintain our awareness, just like the sun maintaining its warmth on that one lotus. Because if the sun goes behind a cloud, then that lotus petals close up. The sun has to maintain its warmth uninterrupted for a long time for all the petals to open up. In the same way that we have to maintain our awareness uninterrupted for long periods of time for the mind to open up and go deep inside. So when one starts meditating, it does not matter what you're experiencing at the beginning. It can be sloth and torpor, it can be restlessness. It doesn't really matter where you start. As long as you realize to continue your mindfulness uninterrupted on whatever you're experiencing, just being aware, and you'll find quite naturally the experience you have now will open up and you go deeper. Because I've obviously been meditating many, many, many years, you can see that when the ordinary experience opens up, inside of that, that's where you find the present moment. Obviously, the present moment is the middle of time. So as your mind opens up, just through mindfulness, you'll find that you'd come quite naturally to this experience of now, the present moment. And as your mind continues to open up, you're just mindful of now without moving, you'll find that opens up and you come into the state of silence. Silence is just a refinement of the present moment. It lies right within the middle of the present moment, not outside of it, but within it. And right in the center of the present moment and in silence, you will find your breath emerges. You may think this is strange, but many people who have followed my instructions say that when you just go into the experience you have now, into the time to get silence, to get present moment, into the present moment to get silence, and you just wait in the silence for a while, it's as if the breath emerges from within that, and the breath which you experience naturally that way is always far more peaceful, far more beautiful, and far more easier to watch than when you deliberately try and find the breath. It comes naturally as you go in. And in the middle of that breath, if you stay with it long enough, quite naturally you'll start to see the whole breath from beginning to end, what we call the full awareness of the breath. It happens naturally. You just go deeper into the breath and that's what you see. Just like the petals of the lotus opening up one by one, and as one opens up, you see what's inside. It's always been inside there, but you have to open up its covering to see what it really is. So the full awareness of the breath is actually inside, your ordinary awareness of the breath. And the next stage, you just stay with this full awareness of the breath, and right inside that, you'll find what we call the beautiful breath. You just stay with the full awareness of the breath, and eventually it just turns into something very delightful and pleasant. And soon you go inside the beautiful breath. And for many people, that's where they're experiencing the breath disappearing. The breath is not disappearing. You're just going deeper inside to see what's right in the middle of that beautiful breath. And for many of you, what actually happens is you're experiencing the breath in a different way. Before, you were experiencing the physical sensation of the breath, the touch. And as that subsides and calms down, now you're experiencing the mental experience of the breath. You're not feeling the breath, you are knowing the breath through the mind door. And because it is a different type of sensation, many people miss this and they think, oh my goodness, the breath has disappeared. If I don't breathe quickly, I'm going to die. But, as I said the other day, in all the 25 years or more I've been teaching meditation, I have yet to have a casualty. No one has died on my meditation retreats yet. I suppose there's always a first time. But not in Penang on this retreat. So understanding this, you go deep inside and you get the mental experience of the breath. And a simile which may help you here, you can imagine that one of these girls here with all their long hair decides to go off and become a nun. And so they shave off their hair and they wear these white robes or brown robes. And when you first see her, you think, is that her? And you look and after a while said, oh yeah, that's her. Or like a guy who had long hair and now he goes off into some novice program and becomes a novice and wears brown robes and shave off his hair and beard. You look at him, is that him? After a while you can recognize, yeah, that's her, that's him. It's the same person underneath, but just their outer appearance has changed. And after a while you can recognize them. In the same way that when your breath goes deeper and you get to the mental experience of the breath rather than the physical experience of the breath, it's the same old breath, it just looks a little bit different. But after a while, you can recognize it. So for those of you who experience the breath disappearing, it hasn't disappeared, it's just changed its appearance. And when you get used to that after a while, you don't have to do anything. that what's left when you think the breath has disappeared is the mental experience of the breath. And you just leave it there, it's quite nice. It's still, it's peaceful. You don't do anything, don't move your mindfulness from one lotus to another, otherwise all those leaves or petals close up and you go back to square one again. You just leave it alone and allow the mindfulness to stay, and you find you go even deeper, because right from the middle of that very calm and still breath comes this light called animitta. And that nimitta, that light, you're not seeing it with your eyes. The eyes are closed, you are seeing it with your mental eye. And so often people, when they experience these lights and nimittas, they open their eyes, they're sure the sun is shining into their eyes. Or someone's got a flashlight and shining it into them. But you are not. 99% of the time, if you see that light, it is a real nimitta. And anyway, if you see it today, look outside. There's clouds everywhere. You won't see the sun. And I promise no one is going to go around with a flashlight here. So if you see a light, it is that beautiful nimitta. And what actually is it? All it is a reflection of your mind, the sixth sense. Another way of looking at this meditation and also understanding how it gives rise to the deep insights is a simile of the emperor. Once upon a time, there was a very powerful emperor. He had so much power that people were quite scared of him or her because they didn't know who he was. Because every time they saw this emperor in public, he'd always have five pieces of clothing covering him completely. He had boots covering his feet and going up to his thighs. He had trousers which covered the top of his boots and went up to his waist. He had a jacket which went over the top of his trousers, which went down to his wrists and up to his neck. And he had gloves which went halfway up his arm, overlapping his jacket. And last of all, he had a helmet which completely covered his head and over the top of his jacket. All those pieces of clothing were overlapping. The boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves and the helmet. So much so that no one ever saw who this emperor was. Whether he was a girl or a boy. Whether he was Caucasian, African or Asian. Whether he was from PJ or from Penang. No one could tell who this emperor was because he was always clothed. The only way you can find out who this emperor is to take the clothes off. And then you can find whether he's a boy or girl, old or young, what race. In this simile, the emperor is your mind. The one in control of all this. The one behind the scenes who's in control of your life. It's a very powerful thing, this mind, this emperor. But the problem is it's always covered with the five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch. Like the five pieces of clothing covering the emperor, the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves, and the helmet. The five senses and the five pieces of clothing. And the only way you can find out what your mind actually is and who you really are is to take off those five senses. And that's what you're doing. At this stage, when a nimitta comes up, the five senses are so subdued, they're in the background, they're about to turn off completely. And eventually, when you stay with the nimitta long enough and stabilize it, and eventually get into the jhanas, then those five senses are completely subdued. And at last, you're with your mind. And that's actually what we're doing. We're going deep inside to find out who we are. To find out what this mind truly is. And that simile of the lotus shows how it's done. Just keep the attention on whatever you're experiencing now, and it opens up all by itself. And you go very deep inside. Not only do you see what this mind is, but also, like the lotus, the more you open up, the more delicate are the petals, and also the more beautiful they are, the more fragrant they are. So the deeper you go in meditation, the more beautiful and delicate it gets. That's why I love that simile, because it's so useful. So when you go deep into the meditation, your mind becomes more subtle and it becomes more happy. And if anything, it's a happiness and a subtlety which take you deeper and deeper, just rather than the insights, because you all like a bit of happiness and pleasure. And the mind gives you that happiness and pleasure. So, that simile shows what's going on. You're always going in. So whatever you're experiencing, you don't think, oh, this is not good, I can't meditate, I'm hopeless. Stop complaining and just stay where you are. And if you stay long enough where you are with patience, not doing anything, you will find the mind quite naturally goes deeper into what it's doing. Similar to that TV simile yesterday, when you're watching this TV, even if you had like a round screen or like a diamond screen or like a triangular screen TV, after a while you don't know it's triangular or square or round or rectangular, because you just go into the center of it. You always tend to go into things. Which is why this meditation practice is called insight meditation, because you're going in. You know what the opposite of insight meditation is? Excite meditation. An excite, as it's always looking outside of things, looking to something else, never staying long enough where you are to fully understand and penetrate it. So this is not excite meditation, this is insight meditation. So we're always going in. Another way of looking at this is the simile of the Russian dolls. Because many of you may have seen these little wooden dolls which you used to get from Russia. They're a tourist item. And if you open one out, it's hollow inside, you open it up and inside is an identical doll, a tiny bit smaller. And you take that one apart and inside is a third doll, exactly the same, only more small. And take that apart, it's about 7 or 8 dolls sometimes, until you get the final small one right in the center. Very similar to meditation, because every stage, you've just got to open this stage up now, and it's right in the center where you need to go. So you don't need to go anywhere else. You just have to stay where you are. Be content here, and then you'll go deeper. If you don't believe me, there's another great simile. One of the stories from my experience teaching meditation in Australia. One of the places where I used to teach meditation was in prisons. And one of the first time I remember, the story's in my little book, the first time I went to teach meditation in a prison in Australia. It was a high security jail. And there was about 110 prisoners on the muster, on the list, who were in this jail. And on my first time I went there, I think over 90, maybe 95 prisoners turned up. Imagine that, a 90% attendance rate of these criminals coming to learn meditation. And straight away when I heard that so many prisoners were coming to learn meditation, I thought, isn't this inspiring? Even though these people have done misdemeanors and crimes, have hurt other people, at least they want to try and do something with their lives. They want to try and make amends, become better people. They were sacrificing their morning, coming to listen to me talk about meditation. So many of them wanted to change. Wow, that was so inspiring. And so I thought, wow, if these people want to listen to Dhamma and Buddhism and change their lives around, I am going to really help them. I am going to just bust myself helping these guys. If they've come this far, I'm going to meet them more than halfway. So I started teaching them about meditation. After about 10 minutes of teaching them meditation, one of the prisoners actually stood up, raised his hand to interrupt me and asked, "Can I ask a question?" That prisoner, like many of these guys, were huge, 6'6" or something. And that was just between his shoulders. A huge guy with scars, he looked really mean. He was someone who'd do well battling against a Terminator, and he'd probably win in some movie. He was a big, tough guy. And when anyone that big, you'd make, was it Arnie Schwarzenegger look tiny? Anyone that big, when they interrupt you and say, "Can I ask a question?" I always say yes. And so, what was his question? He said, and this is one of those true stories which you can't make up because it's too funny to make up. He said, "Is it really true? Is it really true that through meditation you can learn to fly through the air, to levitate?" And then I realized why all the prisoners had come to learn meditation. They all wanted to learn levitation so they could escape over the walls. And I found that out to be true, because when I said that, oh, it takes a long time, many years, and only specially gifted meditators can do that. When I said how difficult it would be and how unlikely, the next time I went there to teach meditation, only 3 turned up. That's what they were there for, to learn how to levitate, stupid things. But anyhow, you can't make up stories like that. I wouldn't believe it if it wasn't true. But there they were. They all decided to meditate because they thought they could levitate very quickly and escape. But anyway, at another time, once I became the abbot, and I got so busy coming to Singapore and places like Penang, so I had to give my prison visits to another monk. So he started visiting these prisons. And one day, they said, "Venerable, you've been coming for the last few weeks. Can you stay behind for a cup of tea? You know, because we'd like to be friendly with you and just ask some questions." So he stayed behind an extra half an hour for a cup of tea. And when he was having his cup of tea, they started to ask him many questions. Questions about life in a monastery in the West. "What's it like being a monk?" these Australian prisoners asked. "Well," he said, "we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning." And they said, "4 o'clock? Even in jail you don't have to get up that time. That's terrible." But he did say, "But it is optional. 4 o'clock is optional. You can always get up earlier if you want to." "Then what do you do then at 4 o'clock? Can you sort of, you know, turn on the TV to watch the sort of end of the late night movie?" "No, we don't have TVs in our monastery." "Oh, that's a bit hard. So what do you do then?" "We just meditate." "Oh, I suppose so. You're a monk after all." "But then you have your breakfast. In many monasteries, we don't have breakfast. But we certainly know how to work. In our monasteries, we have to work very hard. Say, I did a lot of building in my monastery. I still do some. I remember on one occasion, I was busy all morning mixing concrete for some of the buildings. And even though I was abbot, I still had to work hard. And anyone who's mixed concrete or been to a building site will notice that all the workers get all splashed with this grey mortar. And so would I. All my robes were dirty with splashes of cement. And even on my face, there was little spots of grey all over the place where the cement had splashed into my face. And as I was going from the building site in the monastery to my hut to take a shower, I passed a visitor, a Sri Lankan lady, who was dressed in a very beautiful sari. She's obviously, you know, quite a wealthy lady. And she'd come to visit my monastery. So I just happened to pass her. It was her first time there. So she stopped me and said, "Can you please tell me where the abbot is?" Thinking very quickly, I said, "If you go up to the dining hall over there, he'd probably be around there. If he's not there yet, he'll be there in about 10 minutes. And so she went up there, and I quickly went to my room, had a shower and got changed. And then I went to talk to her. And after talking to her for about 15 or 20 minutes, she was very impressed. And she said, "Oh, you've got a wonderful monastery here. It's great teaching. It's so inspiring to see, you know, good monks practicing meditation and living simply." But then she said, "If you don't mind me saying, I do have one complaint. On the way up here, I found this monk, and he was so badly dressed. I think you should talk to him." And I said, "I will, madam. I'll talk to him later." Of course, that was me. But we work very hard. And so they told the prisoners how hard we have to work. And the prisoners, when they heard how hard we work, they said, you wouldn't get us working that hard in an Australian prison. No way. We'd riot. We'd go on strike. But then, of course, you have your lunch. In our forest monasteries, not like here, we actually eat out of our bowl. So everything goes together, including all the sweets. Many times I've had ice cream on my curry. Sometimes, if it's a Western meal, you get custard on top of spaghetti. Yuck. And the prisoners said, look, we're supposed to be felons, people who've done terrible things. This is supposed to be our punishment. But even in prison, they give you a tray with different compartments. That's disgusting how you live. What do you do after lunch? You know, can you sort of play sport, have a game of soccer or tennis? So no, Buddhist monks can't play sport. We have to meditate all afternoon. You know, I once thought of starting a Buddhist soccer team. A real Buddhist soccer team, like Mahindarama Football Club. But it would run on Buddhist principles. So when you were playing somebody else, if they really wanted the ball that bad, you give it to them out of compassion. You know, letting go, you have the ball. And if they couldn't score a goal themselves, you'd score one for them, you know, out of kindness, metta. And the goalkeeper would always be saying, the door of my goal is open to you. That's why we don't have Buddhist soccer teams. They'd always lose. So we can't play sport, meditate. Oh, goodness. But I suppose you hang out for dinner. Dinner? In a Buddhist monastery, we don't have dinner. Lunch is our last meal. You're joking, they said. Like, even in solitary confinement, they feed you three meals a day. But not in a Buddhist monastery. Oh, crikey. But what do you do in the evening? And after you've done all that meditation, you know, can you sort of play cards? You know, a game of poker? Or, you know, Scrabble? Monopoly? No, there's no games like that for monks. We just meditate. Oh, not again. Don't you get fed up with meditating all day? Gee, that's a bit much. But I suppose, what time do you go into your bed? And I said, bed? We all sleep on the floor. We don't have beds in a monastery. You don't have beds? Every cell in this jail has a little cot and a mattress on it. And these prisoners were so surprised, but also disappointed that their friend, this lovely monk who they've got to like and even love, was doing it so hard, living in such an austere, ascetic monastery, much worse than their prison. But one of them felt so sorry for this monk. Forgetting where he was, the prisoner said, that's terrible in your monastery. That's so hard. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead? That's the monk who was invited to come and stay in jail. And there was something to that. A prison, especially in Australia, is much more comfortable than a monastery in the West. We are far more austere. So, why is it that everybody tries to escape from prison, but no one tries to escape from a monastery? In fact, monasteries like mine, there's always a waiting list of people trying to join. In prison, there's a waiting list of people trying to get out. So what is the difference between a monastery or freedom and being in a prison? And this is the important part of this story, where it relates to your meditation. A prison is any place you don't want to be. Doesn't matter how comfortable or austere it is, if you don't want to be here, it is a prison. If you are stuck in a 5-star hotel, but you wanted to go home, that hotel would be like a prison for you. A prison is any place you don't want to be. But not only just a physical situation. If you are in a marriage you hate, you want to get out, your marriage is a prison for you. If you're in a job you don't like, your prison, your office is the same. Your office becomes your prison. And if you're in a body which is aching and hurting for some disease, your body feels like a prison. Or if you're in some meditation retreat and you can't wait till 4 o'clock this afternoon when it's finished until you get parole, then this meditation retreat, Mahindarama, becomes a prison for you. And if you're sitting there and there's another hour and a half to go or 2 hours to go for lunch, then you've just put yourself in prison again. A prison is any place or any situation, even any mind state where you don't want to be. You're sleepy. I don't want to be sleepy. Now your sloth and torpor is a prison. I'm thinking too much. I don't want to think too much. Then your restlessness is now a prison. Understand what prison means. Any place, situation, where you don't want to be, is prison. Now, how do you escape from prisons? How do you become free? You don't need to change your husband, your wife. You don't need to change your job. You don't need to leave this hall here and go home. You will find all you need to do is change your attitude from not wanting to be here to wanting to be here, no matter where it is. As soon as you want to be here, you find you are free. So you're sitting here with painful knees. If you want to be here, you're free. If you get restless, if you want to be restless, you're free. To emphasize this, one of the stories I've been telling the last couple of years, after 5 or 6 years as a monk, I was allowed to leave the monastery where I was trained by Ajahn Chah and go wandering around Thailand. I visited some teachers, found some very quiet monasteries, but when it came for the rainy season retreat, I found a very beautiful monastery in the north of Thailand. It was secluded, no other monks were there, and I had all the time to myself. It was absolutely perfect. I couldn't have found a better monastery to spend the 3 months winter retreat or rainy season retreat. So I was happily meditating there. But after 3 or 4 weeks, I started to get restless. All these thoughts started coming into my mind, and I tried to stop them. But strange thing happened. They got worse and worse and worse. And soon I was thinking what I call these days unmonkish thoughts. You can work out for yourself what those are. And I didn't want to think those things. I was a monk. I liked being a monk. But you started thinking of all your old girlfriends, started thinking of romance, sex. Get out. I don't want to think those things. I'm a monk. But they kept coming into my mind stronger and stronger and stronger. Now, the worst thing was I never had any other monk with me. It was the first time alone as a monk. And so I didn't have anyone to talk to. And one day it got so bad, I thought I was going crazy. So I went into the little hall where there's a big Buddha statue. And I bowed in front of that Buddha statue and said, "Help." And an idea came into my mind, a strategy. Probably because I was a Westerner, I thought, let's do a deal. And the deal was this. My mind would behave itself and watch the breath for 23 hours of the day. But for 1 hour, from 3 p.m. until 4 p.m., every afternoon, my mind could do whatever it wanted. I would give it free permission to think about sex, girlfriends, romance, anything it wanted, from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m., but the rest of the day, it behaves. I thought that was fair. If my mind wanted to think about all those things, do it from 3 to 4, the rest of the time, behave. That was the deal. But what happened was not quite as I expected would happen. When I went back to meditate, my mind was still as thinking and restless as it always was. Still those thoughts came in and I had to fight them back, beat them away. And oh, by 3 p.m. I was so tired. Like many of you do become when you try and fight your mind. But I wasn't going to give up. I fought all the way. And so when it got to 3 p.m., I was quite tired. I went up to my hut and leaned against the wall and put my tired feet out. And I said, okay, now's the other part of the deal. It's 3 o'clock. Mind, you can think whatever you like. Even the most unmonkish thoughts. Every old girlfriend, romance, sex, even strange stuff. You can think whatever you want. And for the next hour, my mind watched every breath go in, every breath go out. It was so peaceful and quiet. Not a thought came into my mind. That's what happened. And it was a crazy experience, but I learned from that the difference between doing, letting go, and letting go of doing. For most of that time, I was doing the letting go. Come on, let go. Come on, get out of here. Come on, let go. Come on, be peaceful. Come on, watch the breath. That's doing letting go. And for that 1 hour, I'd let go of doing. Oh, whatever you want to do. Sex, romance, science fiction, whatever you like to think about, you can. That was called letting go of doing. And it completely surprised me. I was really peaceful. Reason is because for that hour, whatever happened, I was happy to be there. I give myself freedom. Wherever you are, whatever you're experiencing, be happy to be here. And that's called freedom. If you don't want to be here, you're in prison. Now if you try that with your meditation, for anyone who's still had trouble with restless mind or sloth and torpor, isn't it the case you don't want to be there? You're trying to get somewhere else? You'll find that that's the reason those negative mind states continue. If you say to this stupid old mind, never mind, I'm happy to be with you, straight away you're in the present moment. When you're happy to be here, there's no problem, so you stop thinking. The only reason why you're thinking, you've got something to do, you've got a problem to fix. If you're happy to be here, I mean really happy to be here, content to be where you are, there's nothing to think about, there's nothing to go, nowhere to go. You stay still. And that's where you start going inwards. When you're happy to be here, silence comes, present moment is just always here. And you find the breath is there, you're happy to be with this breath no matter what it feels like. You don't want to try and get into any other stage because you're always happy to be where you are. Because you're happy to be where you are, you're focusing on this layer of petals and it just opens up quite naturally. And soon you're happy to be in jhanas because it just occurs all by itself. And so that's how to develop freedom. Whatever you're doing in your meditation, stop complaining. The biggest enemy to meditation is what I call in my monastery the fault-finding mind. The fault-finding mind. No matter what's happening, you can always see something wrong with it. Even no matter what monk gives to, even the Buddha, you can find fault with the Buddha. You can find fault, even if you apparently the most expensively paid supermodels, they always have a pimple somewhere, which is why on the glossy magazines You have to airbrush those models, I don't know, about 20 times before you get the final picture. Real people don't look perfect. Everyone's got something wrong with them. But if we develop the fault-finding mind, we see all that imperfection and it always gives us work to be done. But if you don't develop the fault-finding mind, but the appreciative mind, the accepting mind, that this is good enough mind, that I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to be with you, and I'm happy to be with my body, and I'm happy to be with my crazy mind type of attitude, then there's no more fault finding. Because there's no fault finding, you get so peaceful, so still, and you find the meditation takes off. So be careful, no fault finding, and be happy to be here. And then you find you get very, very peaceful. When you go home, you have to be fault finding. You have to go to work and fix up things. But now, no fault finding. And then you get so peaceful, so still. You're no longer in a prison, because at last you want to be here. And when you want to be here in this moment with this mind, you find it gets very peaceful all by itself, naturally. So that's how you go in. A deeper teaching on meditation. So any questions about that before we go on to the paper questions? Has anyone got any questions about insight meditation? Going in, yes. Aha, the time scale. That once there was a carpenter who was making furniture. And this carpenter got a piece of wood from the shop. And the carpenter looked at that piece of wood and saw this piece of wood, it's already been sawn to about the right size. It's been planed down to take all the saw marks off. It's already been sanded. Actually, it only needs a very fine sanding and a polishing, and it's good enough for furniture. It doesn't take him that long. But the same carpenter sometimes gets a rough piece of wood from the yard and it's all sort of bent and a bit warped and it's got all the saw marks on. So he said, well, this is a rough piece of wood. I better sort of plane it down first of all. And once it's planed down, you get the roughest grain of sandpaper, then the medium-sized sandpaper, and then the finest sandpaper, and finally he polishes it up. It takes a long time. Because the skillful carpenter, like the skillful meditator, he looks at his mind, it'll always be different, and finds what does it need. Sometimes your mind is so refined, it just needs a little polish, and it's very, very deep in meditation. Even the most skilled meditators, they may have been working very hard, tired or sick, and it takes them a long time to actually to get quiet. It depends what you're working with. The trouble is that carpenter has an apprentice who's very lazy. And he hears that this carpenter can take a piece of wood in 1 or 2 seconds, can make it into furniture. So he gets this rough old piece of wood and starts polishing it with a cloth. And he goes through so many pieces of cloth and gets very frustrated, because the skilled meditator knows when it's going to take a short time, when a long time. So as for you, develop your skills. Little by little, you'll know just how to take those shortcuts later, but not now. Because sometimes people always want to know the shortcut, the fast way to Nibbana. Because, oh, you're so busy, you haven't got much time. Let's get Nibbana out of the way before New Year so you can start enjoying yourself. That's one less thing you have to worry about. Be careful. So it really depends. It takes sometimes long, sometimes short, depending on what the meditator has to work with. So you can't say. Okay, let's go for the any other questions from the floor, which always get precedence. Going gone. Here we go. So we have the first question from the piece of paper, which is, when the mind gets calmer, the breath is harder to detect. In this case, what should we focus on? I think I made the answer there. When it gets very, very calm, it actually, the physical feeling disappears and you're left with the mental feeling. What should you focus on? Whatever is there. So don't try and say, what should I look at? Should I look at this and should I look at that? What are you looking at now? There must always be something you're aware of, even if you call that nothing or peace or stillness. Watch that. Stay with that. Don't move. That will develop by itself. In interviews, I've told many people, it's like going out from a lit room into the darkness. When you go out from a lit room into the dark, at first you can't see, because your eyes need time to accommodate. The pupils have to dilate. And as the pupils dilate and the eyes get used to the darker light, then you start to see things. You can start to see the buildings and the trees and whatever else is out there. It takes 1 or 2 minutes for your eyes to accustom itself to the darkness. In the same way, when the breath disappears or gets quite peaceful and still, it takes a short while for your mind to accustom itself to the more subtle images of when the breath starts to disappear. So when you think there's nothing going on, wait until you start to see something. But don't move, because if you move to something else, it's like the sun goes on to another lotus, and all that hard work, everything closes up again, and you have to start from scratch. Such a waste of time. So, understanding the lotus, you don't have to go anywhere. Wherever you are is more than good enough. And after a while, you'll understand what happens. Your mindfulness just needs to strengthen a bit. Just like when you go out from the lit room to the dark, the eyes have to accommodate to the more subtle images. Just wait, be patient, and your mind will see what to do next. Good question. Hope you enjoy the answer. Next question. I always very often have sexual thoughts. I still experience it even though I've tried many avenues of letting go, exercise, meditating. Am I sick or do I need medical attention? Please advise. No, you're a normal human being. But I think I maybe mentioned a strategy there. If you have lots of sexual thoughts, give yourself 1 hour every day to have your sexual thoughts. And the rest of the day, watch your breath. And after a while, you find out the more you try and stop these things, the more you give them energy. If you don't believe me, look in my book at the story of the demon who came into the emperor's palace. I think most of you should know that by now. The demon who came into the emperor's palace, I'll just say it in brief, this terrible monster came into this palace while the emperor was away. And he was so frightening, so ugly, that all of the guards and soldiers who should be defending the place froze in terror, allowing the monster to go right into the throne room and sit on the emperor's chair. As soon as it sat on the emperor's chair, all the soldiers and ministers said, "Get out of here! You don't belong! Who do you think you are?" And of those few unkind words, unkind deeds and unkind thoughts, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and more frightening. And that made all the soldiers and ministers, people working in the palace, even more upset. They clenched their fists. They got out their swords. They got out their M16s. "If you don't get out of here, we're going to sort of riddle you with bullets." But every unkind word, deed or thought, the demon just grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and his language got worse and worse. And it was a long time before the emperor came back. And when he came back, the demon was so big it took up half the throne room, like this size hall, a demon taking about half the room. And he was so ugly, so smelly. The stench coming off him would make a maggot sick. And they got terrible language. But the emperor was smart. The emperor, that's why he was an emperor, because he was clever. He looked at the situation and straight away knew what to do. He said to the demon, "Welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet or something to drink? What would you like? We have all sorts of different types of tea. We've got Darjeeling, Earl Grey, English breakfast. We have chamomile tea. Or we have herbal tea. Would you like some soy milk with it? Do you want sugar, one lump or two, brown or white, organic or whatever? Or would you prefer honey?" And this emperor was so kind to that monster. The monster started to shrink. And every kind word, every kind deed, even every kind thought, the monster got an inch smaller, less ugly, less terrifying, and his language got better. And everyone realized their mistake. So even the soldiers started being kind to the demon. One of the soldiers got hold of the demon's feet and gave him foot massage. Have you ever had foot massage? Oh, it was just so nice. The demon was so happy. And another minister climbed up a chair and gave his back a massage. Because, you know, these monsters have these huge heads and they get terrible neck and backache. So he gave him a good massage and the monster, "Oh, this is really nice. Just over here. Oh, yes, that's nice." And every kind deed, every kind word, every kind thought, the demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less offensive, less smelly. And all the people in the palace, they really laid on the kindness so well that soon the demon was back to the size when he first came in. They never stopped. They carried on laying on the kindness and the compassion. Until one point the demon was so small, they just needed one more act of kindness and that demon vanished completely away. And the Buddha calls such demons anger-eating demons. They feed on negativity. And the more negativity you give them, the bigger they get, the uglier, the more of a problem they become. Your sexual thoughts were anger-eating demons. "Get out of here, you don't belong." If you say that, you'll find it gets stronger, more problem, more ugly. And that's what happened to me when I said, "Oh, from 3 to 4, you're welcome." Because I was kind, they vanished completely away. Understand? This is psychology. Buddhist psychology to get rid of negative experiences. Say, "Welcome, thank you for coming." When I feel my body start to swing, my mind fell to it. However, it starts to swing again after a few minutes. What should we do? Stop meditating or continue to meditate? Yeah, swing. Be a swinger. No, you're not swinging. It feels that way, but you are not swinging. If you still don't believe me, we'll get someone here to videotape you while you're meditating. And I guarantee that you will be so surprised you're sitting perfectly still, but you think you are swinging. This is just the mind plays tricks on you, and it's quite common. It's a very good sign, because it usually shows you your mind is getting peaceful. Just wondering, should a person have abortion due to financial difficulties or bad timing in life, will the person suffer any unforgiveness in their life? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, abortions. Abortions are an incredibly difficult situation because for most women facing that problem, it's already like a choice between the worst of two bad decisions or the best of two bad decisions. Obviously, the best thing is not to get yourself into that problem in the first place. Restrain, use contraception, be mindful so that you don't get caught out that way. And most pregnancies, or unwanted pregnancies, are a result of a little bit of heedlessness. Now, these days, we've got pretty good contraception. Obviously, if you don't look after it, sometimes it could not work. such as you're on the contraceptive pill and you are sick that day, you vomit up or something, you know all the problems and all the ways of getting around those problems, and usually that you can control, you know, your body. However, there's sometimes, because of our heedlessness or because sometimes it's beyond our control, sometimes these things happen and you've got to make a decision, and it's not an easy decision to make. As far as Buddhists are concerned, we do have five precepts, and killing is breaking the five precepts. However, sometimes you're in a very difficult situation. It's not that easy. For example, that when I was visiting my mother in UK some years ago, she was watching the news on her TV, I was watching it with her, and there was a very fascinating case in the hospital, I think in Swansea, could have been Cardiff, one of those two cities, where a woman was in hospital pregnant, she had two fetuses in her womb, she was going to have twins, and it was absolutely sure, 100%, that if no one intervened, both two fetuses and the mother would all die. However, if the doctor aborted one of those fetuses, then the other one and the mother would both survive. So it was one of those choices. Either two people die or three people. Sorry, one person dies or three people died. And I was fascinated to hear the arguments coming from some people saying, no, 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 just let God take care of this. Or let karma take care of this. Don't intervene. The point was the doctor had that duty of care. He was already the doctor. Doing nothing was still an act of negligence. What in law is called non-feasance. You've got malfeasance when you do something and do it wrong, or non-feasance when you have a duty, you should have done it, but you didn't. So while everyone was arguing about it, the doctor aborted one of the fetuses. So the other one would survive, and so would the mother. And to me, as a Buddhist monk, I said, well done, doctor, you did the right thing. That's the only good thing you could have done. So to save two lives at the expense of one. Because that was his duty, he was in that situation. So because of that, the virtue, the morality, is much, much deeper than the five precepts. The five precepts are an approximation. Deeper than that is what you are going to do. Is it going to harm another being, harm yourself, or help another being, or help yourself? That was the Buddha's advice to his son Rahula about morality. And if it really is going to help, otherwise lessen the harm, then it's a moral thing to do, according to Buddhism. Usually that always means, or 99.999% of the time, it means keeping the precepts. There's always these one or two occasions when it means something different. And this is where you have to look at your intention. While you're doing this, make sure that you've checked out all possibilities, you got the facts straight, to make sure that you're acting out of kindness and compassion, and then you make your decision. And the job of any teacher or monk is to help you make that decision, not to make it for you. And when you made that decision, not to criticize you no matter which way you go. Because I've known many women who've had abortions and they do feel terrible afterwards. And one of the worst parts of their feeling is guilt. And that guilt comes from people who tell they've done an evil thing, you're going to go to hell, you're a murderer, 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 murderer. And I think that's really uncompassionate. The person who's saying that is more a murderer than the woman was. So the thing is to be kind. It's a very, very difficult decision which you have to make sometimes. And at that time you've got no choice sometimes. So that's why, number one, try not to get into that position in the first place. It's a very tough one. And if you're doing that decision, take the path of least harm to all people concerned. And then, after you made that decision, if it is having an abortion, that's the decision you made, please give yourself forgiveness. If you can't give yourself forgiveness, do a forgiveness ceremony. In front of the Buddha, ask forgiveness by body, speech, or mind, whatever I've done. and share the merits with that deceased child. Maybe give a donation, maybe to an orphanage or something, for children who don't have parents, and spread the karma to that deceased child. That's what to do. And then sort of let go. And try not to get in that situation ever again. Such a difficult one. Any comments or questions about that? And again, men can't tell you what it's like. You know, as a monk, that's why I'm looking at you when I'm answering this question. Men can't make the decision for you. It's your body, it's your fetus, and you will carry the consequences, not the father. So because of that, you're the only one who knows what to do. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when a person goes to a different religion and converts, when they die as a Buddhist, what will happen to their soul? Will they go to different places due to different religions? Sadhusadhan, no, of course they don't. People go to heaven if they're good. Doesn't matter if they're a Christian or if they're a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Muslim. No one owns heaven and say it's only for our religion and you guys can't get in. They don't have like bouncers on the door, these big Buddhists, and say only Buddhists can come in. No Christians, no Muslims, no Hindus, no unbelievers. We don't just have just only Theravada forest tradition disciples of Ajahn Brahm can come in, no one else. That's not what happens. Good people go to good places, and that feels right. Doesn't matter what religion you are. If you've been naughty, if you've cheated on your wife, if you've stolen, if you've hurt people, like killed them, just by saying, well, I go to church, therefore I go to heaven, that's not good enough. You have to be a good person to go to good places. Otherwise, it's not fair. And it feels that way. And of course, you don't go to heaven forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever, because no one is that good. You don't deserve to go to heaven forever and ever, do you? You've all been naughty sometimes. But no one deserves to go to hell forever and ever and ever and ever and ever either. No one is that bad. So when I heard about like eternal heaven, eternal hell, that was crazy. That made no sense at all. So the idea of like Buddhist or even Hindu idea, you know, if you've been a bad person, you go down to a lower realm for a while, work out the bad karma, or learn to forgive yourself quickly if you're smart, and then you go leave the bad realms. And if you make lots and lots of good karma, you go to the nice realms for a long time until all your good karma is used up, and then you have to come back down and make some more. It's just like going on holiday. So you go on holiday to this beautiful place, and then when you run out of money, what do you have to do? You have to come back home and go to work again. So it's like you go up to heaven, and then when you run out of good karma money, you have to come back to earth and make some more. That's how it works. After meditating, we should investigate the peace calm. Please explain how this is done. When you're peaceful, what does it feel like? What's it like to be peaceful? Not as a thought, but as an experience. When it's calm, what's calm like? At the end of the meditation, what does it feel like? So I like to pause at the end of every meditation. I just enjoy the peace, the calm. And even so-called bad meditations, you're still more peaceful and calm than when you started. And that encourages you, yeah, it's actually working. And once you start to understand what peace is, what calm is, what freedom is, from your experience at the end of meditation, then you'll incline there again and again and again. The mind loves it so much that it always wants to return to that peace, that freedom, that inner joy. There's so many people in this world would pay a fortune for inner peace. And the sort of calm you've already got, many people, wow, they would value that so much. Once you experience what you have, this beautiful peace and calm, just enjoying this simple retreat, nobody on your back telling you what to do. And as I said at the end of this retreat this afternoon, I am not going to give out report cards. I'm not going to grade you A, B, C, D, E, or F. I know you all think you deserve an F. But then if I did grade you, I'd all give you an A. Isn't it wonderful? You don't have to achieve anything. You're completely free. You can relax and be at peace. No one is going to judge you. So don't judge yourself. That's free, being happy to be here. And once you understand that, you get what in Buddhism we call the taste of freedom, vimutti rasa. And once you have the taste of freedom, it's like tasting the most delicious food. You'll always go back for some more. You get hooked on meditation. Like me, you become meditation junkie. Ajahn Brahm, when attempting to meditate, I feel like I'm in a vault and sometimes they'll be chanting as something as of thought and dark blue light, like lightning. Am I doing it correctly? How do I radiate loving kindness? Is it through chanting or meditation? Okay, if you're going into a deep vault, the Buddha called that the cave of the heart, Hadaya Guha. So you're going into deep into the cave of the heart. You're going in. It's like going into a vault. The chanting you're hearing, that's just the perception playing around. That's okay, but seeing a dark blue light is nice. After a while, that dark blue light, or doesn't matter what light it is, will always turn into a nimitta if you're still and peaceful. So you're getting into deep states. So carry on. You're doing well. How do you radiate loving kindness? The deeper you are in meditation, the more still you are, the more energy you have, and then you can really radiate loving kindness very easy. Just thinking of a person and just zap them with all the power of your kindness and your love. May they be happy and well. Zap. And people do that. I think one of the people in KL said that when they got very deep, they thought of somebody who needed some love and kindness, and they felt this energy coming out of their head, going towards them. And that's what it's like. So when you really get deep meditation, you're like Superman. And Superman, he, with his radiant eyes, goes bang, right into that person, but not with destructive power, with beautiful loving kindness. And straight away, whatever pain or whatever fear they have, it just all melts with the power of your loving kindness. You zap them. While the breath gets clearer, I feel my body getting lighter, like float on the floor. Why and what should I do? Oh, that's a very good sign. This usually happens that when your body gets, when your mind gets still, when the mind gets still, the body gets lighter until it eventually disappears. It doesn't go floating anywhere. There's people have very nice meditation on these retreats, but you've never seen anybody, you know, midway in the air or sort of on the ceiling, and you have to sort of, you know, pull them down for lunch. But sometimes it feels like that. It's just the perception is starting to become free of its bounds, and you have these weird experiences, but it's all okay. It's all in the mind. Don't need to worry about a thing. Just enjoy the lightness. And after a while, the body will disappear. And once it disappears, all you've got left is a beautiful mind. You're getting peaceful. Well done. What should I know when nimitta arises, breath or nimitta? Just don't do anything. Just allow the mind to choose whether it wants to watch the breath or wants to watch the nimitta. Just let the mind decide. So whatever's in the mind, that's what you watch. So the mind wants to go back to the breath, let it go back to the breath. It wants to go to the light, let it go to the light. You are as still as possible. What's happening, like the symbol of the lotus, the nimitta petal, or the breath petal is almost open to release the nimitta, but then it's not fully open. It's like a petal which is half open. So you can see the nimitta, you can still see the breath, and you don't really know what's going to happen next, whether that petal is going to close, so you just got the breath, or it's going to open fully to see the nimitta inside. So just leave it alone to see what happens. But just don't move, don't do anything. Allow the mind to decide. My mind is so difficult to calm down, wandering here and there. How to calm the mind down? When do sitting meditation, the mind wanders here and there? I think I've already answered that. Make peace with the mind. Don't make war. Be gentle. Don't be violent. Be kind. Remember the story of the anger-eating demon. And your mind is like a monster in there, thinking all over the place. So tell your mind, welcome. Thank you for at least being here. At least I'm not crazy, at least not yet. So thank you for being here. And then when you're kind to the wandering mind starts to get less and less and less of a problem. And it settles down. Anger-eating demon. The more angry you get, the more the mind moves. What is the meaning of your Pali name? I said that yesterday. That's Ajahn Brahm, is Buddhist, Buddha, Roman Catholic, Anglican. Oh, I think we've got the old questions here. The other galaxy question, did that one? No, got some new questions here. What's this one? Can monks do gardening, e.g. pulling the weeds or pruning the trees? Yes, we do gardening all the time, pulling the weeds out of the mind, pruning the trees from the dead wood of bad sila and bad thoughts. So we're gardeners of the heart. When any bad things happen to us, any painful experiences, that's just fertilizer for our hearts. So we dig in the pain of life and the difficulties and disappointments into our hearts. As one of my favorite anecdotes is, and you've probably heard this last year, whenever you tread in the dog shit, never ever scrape it off your feet. Always take it home with you. If you don't take it home, take it into the temple. And dig it under the mango tree. There's always a mango tree in the temple or at home somewhere or next door. And when you dig that dog shit under the mango tree, 1 year later, the mangoes will be much sweeter than ever before. And when you taste those sweet mangoes, always remember what you're really tasting. Dog shit transformed into the sweet, delectable mango nectar. So that's how you deal with the dog shit of life, the pain, the sicknesses, the cancers, the disappointment, all the abortions. Dig it in. Do all arahats endowed with psychic powers? Is it okay to aspire to get psychic powers? What do you want to get psychic powers for? Gee, imagine reading people's minds. Are your minds interesting to read? Who would want to read your mind? Come on. So it must be terrible having psychic powers and reading everybody's minds. Oh my goodness. It's just like reading trashy novels every day. Or like watching these soap operas like Neighbours, Home and Away, Coronation Street, and all these other soap operas they have in the West. Oh, or watching Big Brother. I've never seen Big Brother, but it's one of these reality shows which is supposed to be really boring, but everybody watches. That's like reading people's minds, like watching Big Brother. Oh my goodness, that's the last thing you wanted to do. And anyway, if you could read people's minds, what would happen? You would be invited by the Malaysian Secret Service to find out who is a real terrorist and who isn't. You'd have to be on duty at the airports, looking at people coming in, looking at people going in, reading their mind, reading their mind. That person's a terrorist. That person's got whiskey in their bags. That person is getting drugs into the country. Because you'd be much, much better than any of these other detectors. They probably put you in a cage next to the detector dogs and just feed you once a day and make you work. So it'd be a terrible thing. Imagine you could fly through the air. You could levitate. That'd be even worse. The Malaysian government would get hold of you and make you compete in the Beijing Olympics, high jump. So it's best that you... The only psychic power which the Buddha recommended and praised is a psychic power to teach the Dhamma. They call that a psychic power, the ability to teach and inspire others. He said that's the only one which he recommends. What is your own personal motivation for practicing the Dhamma? I've got nothing better to do. Nothing better to do than practice the Dhamma. What else do you want to do in life? Gee. Make money? What do you want money for? How much do you need to make money? You know, do you want to have sex? You know, so what? You know, as a young lad, been there, done that. Want to get married again? Have another husband? More argument? Nah, 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 nah. Have more kids and have to wake up in the middle of the night? So practicing Dhamma is the very best. So I've got nothing better to do. Anatta means no soul, no self. So when we are meditating, who actually is doing the meditating? Ah, good question. No one is doing the meditating. When you realize that no one is doing the meditating, you've got nothing to do. So shut up. Stop trying. For many of you, delusion is doing the meditating. That's why it don't work. Delusion is making more delusion. Now this is for those, the monks, and those skilled meditators. For the last rains retreat, I was focusing on one sentence in one verse in one of my favorite poems in the Visuddhimagga. And the one verse I was focusing on was this: the path is, but no traveler on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not the one who enters it. And it was the first half I focused on. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. In other words, where there's a traveler, there ain't no path. The more you're doing the meditation, the more the path disappears and vanishes. But the more you disappear and vanish, when there's no traveler, the path is as wide as a major highway. And you just can't go off it. It's just too wide. As long as you do this meditation, it's such a narrow path, you're always falling off. But when you let go, when you disappear, when the traveler vanishes, then the path manifests. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. Which means when there's no traveler, then the path is wide and clear. So that's a nice thing for you to think about. Ajahn, if you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be and why? That's easy, eh? Bodhi tree. You should have known that one. That's a dead giveaway, a Bodhi tree. Because I'd have the privilege of looking after the Buddha. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to do? To sort of shade this wonderful being and give him enlightenment. Oh, that's the tree I'd be, a Bodhi tree. What does right concentration, the Noble Eightfold Path, refer to? The fourth jhana, or it refers either to first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, or fourth jhana. Any one of those is sufficient to become enlightened. You don't need all four, but the more you get, the easier it is. But the minimum requirement is first jhana. May we know why, when one enters the state of Nirodha Samapatti, why one is not destroyed by flood or fire. I don't know why, but that happens. If you don't believe me, give it a try. And if I'm wrong, I'll apologize. You get into Nirodha and we'll put you on a big fire. We'll put you in a lake and dump you with a lump of concrete on on your feet and drag you up 1 week later to see if you're still alive. Scientific test. But you've got to get Nirodha first of all, this incredible deep state of meditation. Okay, during sitting, when one has come to a stage where there is stillness and one tends to wait there, one gets lost most of the time. Can Ajahn please advise us how to overcome this state of mind? As I said, just wait there long enough for the mindfulness to increase, just like the eyes get more sensitive in the dark. Sooner or later, you become aware of what to watch at that time. It becomes more aware. If that's still a problem, then don't go so deep so quick. Stay with the breath until you've got more sort of mindfulness. The meditation gives tests for mindfulness. At first, you've got to be mindful of the present moment. Many people's mindfulness is not that strong, so they can't even watch the present moment. Then you've got to watch the stillness. Sometimes you can't do that because the mindfulness isn't strong enough yet. It needs to sort of, the silence rather. The mindfulness needs to grow a bit more and become strengthened. Then you watch the breath. Sometimes everyone can watch the breath, you know, breathing in and out 3 times, but it soon disappears. Again, the mindfulness isn't strong enough, isn't subtle enough. So actually, every time you meditate, to go deeper means more powerful mindfulness. And to get to the beautiful breath, you need very strong mindfulness. And when the breath disappears, that's immense mindfulness to be able to watch what happens when the breath disappears. You've got to have a really, really clear, subtle mind. This is just something you build up after practice. And after a while, you can watch what happens when the breath disappears with ease, because your mindfulness is strong enough and clear enough to do that. Let's just carry on. During a sitting, can one move? Can one use more than one object? Should breath become subtle, can one note sitting and touching and vice versa? You can use different objects while you're sitting. You can even combine objects. One of the great combinations is loving kindness on the breath. So look upon your breath as like a being and have loving kindness. The door of my heart is open to the breath. And this breath is so nice. That little breath has been feeding me oxygen ever since I was a little baby. Ever since I came out of my mum's tummy, my breath has been keeping me alive. And I've never said thank you to my breath, and it's so lovely, my breath. When I look upon my breath with tenderness and kindness, then the breath is very easy to watch. So do loving kindness on your breath. Breath, may you be happy and well. May you be free from suffering. May you just flow in smoothly and go out smoothly. And I care for you, breath. You're my best friend. Of all the beings in the world, breath, I like you the most. When you do things like that to your breath becomes so easy to watch. So that's one of the great combinations, loving kindness and the breath. And the last question, may I know where do we come from and how was this universe created? I came from Australia. Some of you came from Penang. Some of you came from London. You came from Hong Kong, wasn't it? So we come from many places. Someone asked Ajahn Chah that. This very, very deep philosopher came to see Ajahn Chah in his hut and said, where do you come from? And without missing a beat, he said, my mummy's tummy. So that's where you come from. They asked, do you come from England? Do you come from Australia? Do you come from Malaysia? You come from your mummy's tummy. From tummy land. And, of course, Ajahn Chah was becoming a joker. He was always tell jokes like that and make people laugh. What do you want to know for? In Buddhism, they give the story of this man who was shot by an arrow. And he wanted to know where the arrow came from, who shot it, what the race was, what type of arrow it was. Whether it was a high-class arrow or whether it had been shot by this low-class, cheapo arrow. And he was asking so many questions, he died before the arrow was pulled out. So, it doesn't matter so much where you come from, but what are you doing here? That's more important. So, who cares where you came from? But what are you doing now? That's most important. And if you really want to find out where you're coming from, you can do, when you get into deep meditation, when I was teaching people at KL, and I gave a whole talk of this in KL, remembering your past lives. If you get into a deep meditation, you're very still and peaceful, you've got lots of joy, then you can ask yourself the question, what is my earliest memory? What is my earliest memory? And in deep meditation, very often, a very, very early memory will come up. Just like your first weeks of life or being in your mother's womb. And if this really works, only after a deep meditation, you're actually back there re-experiencing the event with no doubt that that was you. And then you can even say, earlier, please. An event will come up from a very long time ago. A different body, a different time. And that was you. You remembered your past lives. That's not your original where you came from. That's just where you've come from recently, from your previous life. You may go and search back for a previous one. There's an endless series of life going so far back, you can't really tell where you originated from. But as far as the origin of the universe is concerned, which universe do you mean? As I said, I think last night, the Buddha remembered 91 universe cycles. 90 Big Bangs. So there's been universe after universe after universe. Life after life after life. So long, so many. It's about time you've had enough. Do you really want to get reborn again? And have to have nappies again? Have to go to school all over again? Have to go to the principal's office again? Have to do your O levels and A levels all over again? Do you really want to do that all over again? So be careful, because otherwise you'll have to do it all over again. Oh no. That's one of my favorite stories about people who could speak when they were born. There's three or four times when people, babies, have spoke in their first days of life. These are real stories, not made up. They really make people very worried, because a baby is not supposed to speak when they're first born, but now and again it does. In a United States hospital, when a baby came out of his mum's womb, in front of the midwife, the doctor, and the nurses, whatever, the baby spoke as soon as it came out from the womb. And what it said, looking around, the little baby, only born a few minutes, said, "Oh no, not again." It was a great quote. It actually happened. The baby realized it got reborn again. "Oh no, not again." So be careful that doesn't happen to you. Make sure this is your last life, so you don't have to keep coming back again and again and again and again. Going to school, going out with the boys, going out with the girls, finding a job. Oh, it's just so much hassle. All of you organizing more retreats, becoming a monk, teaching, you know, having to learn the Vinaya and learn how to meditate all over again. And once you can do that, you've got to go teaching other people. Oh my goodness. Then you go building monasteries, and then you've got to go touring around. Oh my goodness. Then you get tired of all this. Yeah, have enough. No more rebirth. Otherwise you're going to have to do it all over again. From scratch. Got to learn geography and history and sums all over again. Got to go to school. All homework all over again. You got to get married all over again. Have kids all over again. Enough. So anyway, that's enough questions. So I'm not going to do those all over again for sure. So now is 9:30. So is the time for the last interrogations, otherwise known as interviews. If you'd like to come to the interrogation room, down in the library, for the last interviews. And it's another, 9:30, another 2 hours to lunch. Another 2 hours as a chance to let go. To be at peace, to learn freedom, to be happy to be here. So don't go thinking of this afternoon and what you're going to do when you leave this retreat. Don't go packing. How many people have packed their bags already? You haven't finished yet. So don't pack your bags until the last moment. Otherwise, you're wasting too much time. So that way, don't remember that first story I told about the monkeys? And about collecting the bananas, peeling them and even putting them in their mouth, because that's what we're going to do. So I know you've got to pack your bags, but don't do it till the last minute. Don't be like the monkey. And have a happy meditation.